I start off with a simple question. Have you ever asked yourself, why am I here? What am I doing here? Not as in why am I sitting in the seat, but rather why do I exist? What's my purpose in life? And in terms of self-awareness, why do I do what I do? What decisions have I made that have led me to where I am in life right now? Hopefully the answer is yes. Hopefully you have given this some serious thought. But there are really two steps in this process. The first is the machshava itself, the ideas, the principles, the concepts, the fundamental roots, which basically are the underlying reasons for everything in reality. This is what we've been developing in depth for the past couple months in our machshava series, which is right now in YU Torah. The basis of all this is obviously in Gemara Tanakh, but it's expressed through the ideas of Maharal, the Ramchal, the Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Tzadok, the Arizal, etc. This is the machshava, the ideas themselves. But the next step in the process is the hashkafa, which is the strategy you take to actually accomplishing these ideas, accomplishing your purpose in life, accomplishing why you are here. Now, every one of us wants to live a greater, more meaningful life. We want to live a life of purpose, of growth, of contribution to Klal Yisrael, of contribution to something greater than ourselves. We want to live a life of love, of connection. But what most of us struggle with is finding an actual system that enables us and helps us live the life we dream of living. Don't you want to live a greater life? Become a better person? Become a bigger Talmud Chacham? Devote your life to something greater? The first and most important question you have to ask yourself is, what is my purpose in life? That's the what, that's the why, that's the ideas themselves, the machshava. But the second and almost equally important questions you need to ask yourself is, what's the absolute best way to fulfill my purpose in life? What's the absolute best hashkafa? What is the absolute best way to devote my life to Hashem? Now, the problem is that we get so stuck in our way of life that we rarely take a step back and sincerely question the validity of the way that we live. If you're born into a certain home or a certain culture or lifestyle, it's so hard to actually break free of that. So people tend to go through the motions, almost like robots or zombies. Even people who are learning Torah seriously, who are growing, it's so hard and so rare for people to actually step outside of themselves, to step outside of their lives, and to look at life objectively. To ask the real questions. To ask, okay, I know what's been done, I know what people are doing, but what is life really about? What are we supposed to be accomplishing? And is the system really making sense? Does this system really help us live the lives we're supposed to live? And that's really where my story began. I began a quest to find, number one, the what and the why, meaning why are we here? What's our purpose in life? What exactly are we supposed to be doing? But number two, the how. What is the absolute greatest hashkafa? What is the greatest, most ideal community that would help us fulfill our purpose in life? That would help us live the life that we're supposed to be living? And there are really two questions. Number one, does it already exist? If so, I'm definitely going to join. But if not, then we have to create it. If the ideal is in principle, but it doesn't exist, we have to create it. So that is really the question. The question is, number one, what is the purpose of life? Number two, is there a system, or if there isn't, we have to build the system that best enables us to really succeed in our purpose in life. So this year is an introduction to that journey which I've taken in order to really understand what the ideal hashkaf in life really is. So before we enter, before we really begin, I'd like to just set a couple basic guidelines to this year. The first guideline is that you really need to listen to the entire presentation, the entire shiur, in order to really understand everything, because everything is connected. So in order to really understand it, you have to see it in context of everything else. Number two, instead of explaining every single principle and idea in great length, I'm simply going to guide you to the specific machshava shiur which fully explains each concept. And the reason is basically twofold. Number one, because we're focusing on strategies. This year is on how to succeed in life. We gave a whole series on the actual machshavim principles, so instead of spending so much time on that, I'm simply going to guide you to the necessary shir, which will shed light onto that principle. And that really gets to the second reason, because if we spent this year really delving into the machshavim principles themselves, it would never end, because we've given a tremendously lengthy series on the machshava. So this is really the application of the Machshava series which we've been given. Now, Chas V'Shalom, I don't want you to think that the only way you can learn the Machshava and these ideas is through our Machshava series. I'm just trying to give you an easier way of accessing the ideas that we've already developed and that we've been developing without forcing you to search for all the material on your own. Now, the third guideline is that I just want to apologize if I overgeneralize. Now, there are exceptions to everything, so every statement I make would definitely need to be nuanced, need to be qualified, and have a bunch of qualifications, but for the sake of clarity, I might generalize some of the ideas just to make sure that everything's clear. And number four is that this might be a pretty lengthy shiur, hopefully it won't be too lengthy, but instead of splitting up into a bunch of different multi-part shiurim, which you might not listen, you might listen to, I decided it's much better to keep it in one shiur. Now, we've all been there where you listen to part one of a series, you listen to part one of a shiur, and then you tell yourself, I'll listen to the next part tomorrow or next week, and then 3 years later you wake up, and we've all been there. So instead of doing that, I'd rather put it all in one shiur. Now, you can decide to listen to part now, part later, but the ideal way of listening to this type of shiur is to listen to the entire thing at once, simply because everything connects, and in order to really understand every point, it needs to be held in light and in context of everything else. So that's the basic introduction. The basic introduction is that we've been developing for months now the Machshava series, which is on Vayu Torah, which is the big ideas of life. But now we're going to start discussing the Hashkafa. What's the ideal system to enable us to succeed in these ideas, these principles? Now, before we start discussing the actual Hashkafa, we do have to briefly go over some of the absolutely most fundamental points that we've been developing in the Machshava series. The first and most fundamental principle possible is the goal of life. What is our goal in life? As we discussed in such depth in the first two shiurim in the Machshava series, our goal in life is to grow. It's to become the very best people we can be, and to contribute our lives to something greater than ourselves. That means mastering yourself, mastering your mind, learning Torah, learning wisdom, mastering your emotions. As opposed to being used by your emotions, you use your emotions. You don't let your emotions control you. And the same thing when it comes to your body. Master your body. Don't be used by your physical urges. There are people that they are used by their physical urges. If they have an inclination or an urge to eat something, they have to eat it. But the goal is to use your body, to use food, use sleep, to enable you to fulfill and succeed in your goal in life. Relationships, mastering relationships, developing your relationships with people, with loved ones, with your friends, mastering and developing your relationship with Hashem, bringing Him into your life, developing self-control, negating your ego, and most importantly, then contributing everything you're building in your own life to Klal Yisrael, becoming part of something bigger than yourself. Now, as we developed in the second shiur in the Machshava series, this is why Hashem created us. As the Ramchal explains in Derech Hashem, in the beginning of Mesil Shesharim, and in much greater depth in Das Tfunos, we are here to become perfect, to become godly. We're never going to be perfect, but our life is supposed to be a journey of becoming. Now, the problem and the challenge is that most people think we're going to live forever. If you just put it into context, have you ever experienced death? No! You've only experienced being alive. So most people don't live with a sense of, yes, I really need to accomplish. They think they're going to live forever. It's only when you get to a certain stage in life that you start to really become aware of the fact that, yes, I'm aging, I'm going to die. But to take it a step further, time is dying. Just think about it for a moment. Where's the past? It's gone. As the Ibn Ezra famously said, the past is gone. The future, it's not here yet, and the present is constantly fading into the past. So where are you? You are what you've been extracting from every moment in time. If you're riding the waves of time, taking advantage, then you're carrying yourself through time extracting every moment. And if you think about it for just another moment, look into your memories. Your memories are the actualized aspects of your life. They're all the things you've done, you've accomplished. The mind you've built, the midos you've been developing, the relationship with Hashem, the relationship with all your friends and your loved ones. This is who you are. It's what you've been building. It's what you've become. Now, who have you become? That's the question you need to be asking yourself. Who have you become? It's really actually quite troubling. If you ask someone, just anyone, not you of course, but if you ask someone on the street, what's your goal in life? What's your destination? He'll probably look at you a little strange and say, I don't know. But imagine for a moment, you're sitting in the car with someone and you ask the driver, excuse me, where are you going? Now imagine the driver said, I don't know, I'm just driving. You'd think he's crazy. What do you mean you're driving? You're in a car, where are you going? Now imagine you're on a train with someone, and you turn to him and say, hey, where are you going? And the guy says, I don't know, I'm just here. You'd think he's crazy. But you ask people in life, where are you going? What's your goal? What's your destination? And they look at you and say, I don't know. In business, I'm sure of it, that at least once a month, maybe once a week, you set your goals. And you say, where are we now? Where do we want to go? And how do we get there? If you're an athlete, you have specific goals. You have a specific diet. You have to exercise a certain way. You have to sleep a certain way. Because you have goals and you constantly assess yourself and figure out how to accomplish your goals. In life, we have to be doing that. The focal point of life is growth. How are we developing? Where are we going? And how are we going to get there? So that's the first step, realizing that life is about growth. But now let's take the second step. What's the second fundamental principle that we've been developing for a long time in the Machshava series? That is the nature of the physical world, the world we live in. Now, if you ask a lot of people, they'll tell you that the physical world is just a place. It's a place where we learn Torah. It's a place where we think, where we learn, where we grow, where we build relationships. It's just a place. And if you ask a philosopher, how did Hashem create the world? He'll likely tell you that Hashem just created the world, that there was nothing, and then boom, Hashem created the world. But let me ask you a question. A lot of the things we learn in Torah is about the spiritual concept, spiritual world. Neshama, malachim, all these spiritual concepts. How are we supposed to relate to spirituality, to something spiritual, if we've never seen it? For example, imagine trying to describe a color to someone which he's never seen. Imagine someone's never seen the color blue. Now you're trying to describe, imagine a blind person has never seen the color blue, and you're trying to describe to him what the color blue looks like. You're never going to be able to do it. Now imagine for a moment someone's never tasted chocolate. They've never even seen chocolate. And you're trying to describe to him what chocolate tastes like. It's impossible. Unless you've actually experienced it, you'll never know what it is. So how are we supposed to relate to the spiritual? But the idea is so beautiful, as the Ramchal explains in great depth in Derech Hashem. He explains that the physical world is actually an expression of the spiritual. As he explains in Derech Hashem in the second Chelek in Zion, Kol inyonei hagashmiim, shorsham hu bekochos hanibdolim. Everything in the physical world, its root is in the spiritual world, which means that the entire physical world is an expression of the spiritual world. So just to give you an example of what this means, we often describe the Torah as the blueprint of reality. That the physical world is an expression of the Torah, as the famous Midrash says, istakla baraisa bara'alma, that the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world is that he used the Torah itself as the blueprint. So the Torah will be the root, and the physical world will be the expression. And we don't mean the actual physical Torah, Shebeksav, we mean Torah more as a concept in its root form. So for example, just give you another mashal, let's say you have a projector. The image you see on the wall, on the screen, is not the actual image. All you're seeing on the screen is a two-dimensional expression of what was originally in the actual film, being projected through the projector. In order to understand what you're seeing on the screen, you have to source it back to the actual root. For example, let's say you have a seed. The seed would represent the root. The tree is simply an expression of that root. It's the same thing in a human body. I look at you and you are a fully grown human being. but you were once simply a zygote. Half a male and half a female genetic code. And if I really want to understand the full expression of your physical body, I can see everything if I go back to that root. Anyone who wants to understand anything in wisdom always goes back to the root. It's called, in science, they call it guts. Grand unifying theory. That what you really want to be looking for is the root. That's why in science now, they're trying to find the solution to the problem between quantum mechanics and general relativity. They're right now trying to figure out a couple different theories, but that's like a big problem because they're trying to find one ultimate root for everything. So the zygote is that root of the fully expressed human being. If you go back to the genetics, you can see where all of the physical phenomena become expressed. So Torah is that root where everything physical becomes expressed. The spiritual world is the root, and the physical world is simply the expression. So now we ask our question, how are we supposed to understand spirituality? How are we supposed to understand the spiritual world? And what's the answer? It's so beautiful. By understanding the physical world, we can source it back to its spiritual root. By understanding the physical phenomena, we can understand the spiritual world. I'll give you just a beautiful example. When I interact with you, how am I ever supposed to understand or relate to you? Right? You are a neshama. You are a mind, a consciousness. But I can never see your thoughts. I can never see your mind. I can never see your consciousness. So it's actually quite a startling thought. Even the people you love the most, you have never seen them. All you've ever seen is someone's body. And yet, you relate to people. So what's going on? Just to give you a beautiful insight into this, you can never know a person themselves. I can never know your thoughts. I can never know your consciousness. I can never know you yourself. All I can know is how you express yourself to me. Based on the words you say to me, based on your actions, based on your facial expressions, your body language, every way that you express yourself to me outwards is how I come to understand you. But I'll never see your neshama. I'll never see your soul. I'll never see your mind. I'll never see your consciousness. All I can see is how you express yourself to me. So the beautiful principle is that we use the physical to understand the spiritual. Because the physical is an expression and is used as a medium for the spiritual. So if you understand this idea, it gives you an entirely new and profound understanding of Mada. If the physical is an expression of the spiritual, that means that Mada is an expression of Torah. That means that all the principles of biology, of psychology, physics, quantum mechanics, general relativity, philosophy, mathematics, all of them are rooted in the Torah. And when you really understand the Torah principles, you can see it expressed beautifully in all these different categories. So, for example, just to give you a beautiful example, if you learn the Ramchal or the Maharal, they give you such beautiful insight into biology. Or if you read the Maharal, they give you such beautiful insight into mathematics. Or, for example, in terms of philosophy, if you learn the Ramchal or the Arizal or of Tzaddik, you can get a much deeper understanding of all these concepts. And especially if you're learning quantum mechanics and you start learning deeper Jewish wisdom, your mind will be blown. If you, let's say, start learning the Arizal and you start learning quantum mechanics, you'll say, oh my gosh. Because all physical phenomena, all physical wisdom, all the wisdom of this world is an expression of spiritual roots. So by understanding Torah wisdom at its root, the deeper ideas of Torah wisdom, you can understand all of other wisdom as well. But here's the fundamental point. We talk about Torah Mada. The root is Torah. Torah Umada. Torah is the foundation, the ikar. It's the center, it's the root, it's the core. And Mada is an expression of Torah. That means you would see all the leaves as an expression of the seed. When you look at a tree, oh my gosh, there's beautiful leaves and flowers, but it's all an expression of that root, of that seed. So it's not Torah and secular studies. It's Torah and Mada through the lens of Torah. That when you really are rooted deep within Torah wisdom and Torah insight, you can now see all other wisdom through an entirely deeper lens. And everything is connected. Everything is one. That's the basic principle in deeper Jewish wisdom, the achdut, the oneness of everything, how everything is interconnected. So the second fundamental principle is that Torah is the root of everything, and everything else is an expression. The physical is an expression of the spiritual. Mada is an expression of Torah. Now, the third and last principle we're going to be developing today is the individual uniqueness and tafkid of every single person. That every single Jew, every single person really, is absolutely unique. And you all have a specific unique purpose, which then you have to find a way of devoting towards Klal Yisrael, devoting your uniqueness, your individual purpose, towards something greater than yourself. So we're not going to develop this in great depth right now. In Shir number 7, we went into much greater depth than this. But every single person has unique talents, unique gifts, unique abilities, things that they can be passionate about. And their job in life is to cultivate those skills, cultivate those talents, and contribute themselves towards Klal Yisrael. To become the best person they can be, and the next step to expand outwards and contribute that to Klal Yisrael. Now the problem is that so many people feel that I'm not unique, I'm not talented, I'm just normal. There are people that are so unique, that do such extraordinary things, and there are people like me. I just watch people do amazing things. And then they say, how am I supposed to contribute to the world? I don't have anything unique that I can give. I'm just normal, I'm just average, I can't really do anything. But it couldn't be further from the truth. Every person, including you, has a unique purpose in this world. And there's something that only you can accomplish. You were born, you were created with something that no one else can do. And we went into this in much greater depth in Shir number 7. So those are the absolute fundamentals of life. Number one, you are here to grow. You're here to become the best person that you can possibly be in every dimension of life. Number two, the entire world, everything in the world is an expression of something spiritual. And all wisdom is an expression of Torah wisdom. And everything is connected. And number three, you are here with a unique purpose in life. A purpose that only you can accomplish. So these are the basic principles of life. Now if these are the basic principles of life, the machshava, the ideas, what would the hashkafa be? What would the how be? What would the ideal system be? It would be a Torah Umad system. So if you look throughout Jewish history, who are the greatest minds that have ever lived? What have they done? Look at the Rambam. One of the most profound and creative Talmudists who ever lived. One of the most amazing Rishonim who ever lived. And he was a tremendous Talmudist. He was also a tremendous philosopher. He was also a tremendous scientist and a doctor. Look at the Ramban. Also one of the most amazing Talmudists who ever lived. He was an amazing Talmudist and Kabbalist, but he was also a tremendous scientist. He was a doctor too. Look at the Maharal. Also an amazing Talmudist. But he was a philosopher. He was a respected philosopher. Philosophers would come from all over to discuss things with him. He was an amazing mathematician. Look at the Ramchal. One of the most amazing personalities who has ever lived. Mastered Shas and all of Jewish wisdom, but he also studied in Padua. He was a philosopher, a poet. And look at the Vilna Gaon. Obviously he mastered Shas and all of Jewish wisdom, but he was a master mathematician. He knew so much science and so much wisdom. There's an endless list. It seems very clear that the ideal way of living life is to expand your mind. The root and foundation in Iker is obviously Torah, no question. But all of Mada becomes an expression of that. Now, the question we need to be asking ourselves, the real question, is how do you create an environment which enables you to successfully fulfill your goal in life? If our goal is, number one, to live a life of growth and purpose and development, and number two, to live a holistic life where everything's connected, you see all of Mada as an expression of Torah. And number three, you find your unique purpose in life, your unique way of contributing to Klal Yisrael. So you have to create an environment which enables that. So I'll give you a mashal. Imagine you're an airport manager, and you witness a certain problem going on in the airport. What's happening is that people are lying down on the seats in all the terminals, and there's simply not enough chairs for people. And you want to figure out how to solve that problem, because you want to create an airport where there's seats for everyone. So there's a couple options. To simplify, let's give two simple options. One option is that you can put up a sign asking people not to do this. You tell people, we need seats for everyone. If you lie down, there's not going to be enough seats. So please don't lie down. So what's going to happen? Many people are just not going to listen. Many people don't care about the signs. They're just not interested. But you can recreate the environment to solve the problem for you. Imagine instead of asking people, please don't lie down, you buy chairs with armrests. So now no one can lie down. It's impossible. The problem simply no longer exists. The principle is very simple. How do you create an environment which is going to enable us to fulfill our purpose in life? Because our goal is to grow. Our goal is to live a Torah model life. Our goal is to become the best person that we can be, to fulfill our unique purpose. Now the question is, how do we create the system that enables that? That's the real question. So I'm going to overgeneralize for the sake of simplicity, but let's break up the systems into two basic categories. On the one side, we have modern orthodoxy. On the other side, we have Haredi, or let's say right wing. So let's analyze the Haredi system. If you would go over to a modern orthodox Jew and ask him, can you please explain to me the Haredi system? Like, first of all, what's the positives and what are the negatives? Like, why aren't you Haredi? Why aren't you right wing? So what might he say? He might say the positive of the Haredi right wing, it's so clear. The positive is that Torah is everything. Torah is the focus and foundation of their entire lives. There's so much covered on Torah. There's an amazing focus on Torah. For example, I'll never forget this. When I was in Eretz Yisrael, I was at Sohn for Shabbos in Yerushalayim, very, very Haredi family. And the nine-year-old kid, he came over to the Shabbos table and he said, I have something that I'd like to share with you. And he began for, I think, 20 to 25 minutes just pouring out beautiful ideas on a sugya that he learned, not because he had to, but simply because he was curious and wanted to discuss it, wanted to learn it. So another person told me about an 11-year-old that tested him on a sugi he was learning in yeshiva. It's unbelievable. It really is amazing. There is such a focus and value and respect for Torah. It's no doubt and no question the focus of almost everyone's life. Now, what's the negative? What would the modern Orthodox Jew say? Why? What's the negative of this system? You've gotten rid of mana. You've gotten rid of philosophy, of science, of psychology, mathematics. Everything else is just gone. And number two, there's no individuality. There's no uniqueness. Everyone has to be the same. Everyone has to do this. If you don't fit into this exact box, then we basically kick you out. If you're doing anything except for our specific criteria, which are very, very confined, then you cannot be in the system. So they'll say that we don't want that. Why? Because you have to have Torah Mada, and you have to have uniqueness, fulfilling your unique purpose in life. Not everyone is going to be sitting in yeshiva all day. Not everyone can do that. And number three, you're supposed to be going out and affecting the world. You're supposed to be an Or LaGoyim. So now here's the question. And this is really what today's real shiur is going to be about. What's the response? What would the Haredi, what would the right-wing person say about modern orthodoxy? What is the criticism? And here we're going to have to really take a step outside ourselves. Because if I assume many people who are listening to this are modern Orthodox. Now, it's very hard to really hear this objectively if you're inside your own shoes. So I want you to take a step back and open your heart and open your mind. And please just be objective. Think about life outside of yourself. What would someone say if you looked objectively at modern orthodoxy? Not at any individual, but at the system as a whole. What would be the problem? And the problem, I think, is really quite simple. For most people, there's no Torah, and there's no Mada. Meaning, of course you can have rabbis who are very excited about Torah and learning Torah, but in terms of the masses, in terms of the general population, how many people are passionate about Torah? How many people identify their purpose in life as learning Torah and developing their relationship with Hashem, developing their midos? How many people are really focused on that? And here's the sad part, the really sad part. There's not even Mada. It's not like people are so passionate about learning philosophy and physics and quantum mechanics and general relativity and biology and psychology, mathematics. They just don't have time for Torah. That's not the problem. Now, of course, there are exceptions. There's no doubt about it, there are exceptions. There are amazing, amazing people in the modern Orthodox community who aren't even necessarily the Rabbanim, who are just amazing, idealistic Jews. But unfortunately, those are very few. Unfortunately, the masses do not fall into that category. For most people, modern Orthodoxy is basically Hefker. For most people, life is basically about TV, movies, entertainment. Sports is your meaning, it's your religion in life. And secular culture really is your culture. So, for example, many people spend a tremendous amount of time watching TV. So what are the problems of TV? So the obvious number one is content. The content is horrible. Almost all of TV is absolutely dreadful content. Drugs, alcohol, extremely explicit content when it comes to sexuality. There's terrible values. There's all these wrong messages that you're being given. But besides for the content, which is inherently negative, let's say you're watching something which is inherently negative. TV itself is a way of turning off your mind. There's no active thinking. There's no imagination. When you're reading a book, at least you're creating the world inside your mind. If you're reading a novel, you have to create the characters. You have to actively imagine yourself. When you're watching TV, you're basically a zombie. You're completely passive, and everything is just given to you. You completely turn off your mind. But the last step is really the scariest. TV is really just escapism. People watch these TV shows and they fall in love with TV characters. Now, I cannot think of something more sadder than that. These TV characters are fake. They don't exist. And yet you'll have people who actually fall in love. Why? Because they identify with the characters. They fall in love with the personalities of these characters. But they're not real. They don't exist. But why? It's better than your life. You're able to kind of disappear and fade away into this imaginary reality. It's a way of escaping into some fantasy. Instead of dealing with your life, instead of dealing with reality, you get to turn off your life and just escape into this fantasy. Now, the result is that you never end up really living your life. You work, you eat, and then you escape. You work, you eat, and you escape. You go on a vacation, then you work, you eat, and you escape. How can you become a deep, thoughtful, brilliant, compassionate person when nothing you're doing is leading you in that direction? Now, I'm not saying TV can't be used properly. Nothing is inherently wrong with a motion picture as a medium. But the way it is being used is not helping at all. And what's the result of this? What's the result of this entire culture? Where people are just living entertainment, living fantasy, living in TV and movies in that culture. What happens is that kids growing up watching this get these values and it becomes their values. So you have kids that are growing up with the following values. I'll just quickly list off a bunch of them. Number one, you have autonomy. People grow up thinking life is about what I want. You don't have to answer to anyone else. You don't have to answer to Hashem or any supreme being. It's all about you. What do you want in life? What's going to make you happy? Then you have what I call this is who I am syndrome. Which means that people think and they have this perception that who I am is who I am. That I was born a certain way and this is just the way I'm always going to be. You have so many songs telling people that either people are going to love you for who you are or they don't matter and you don't have to care what they think. And you have all these TV shows telling you that you have to basically love yourself for exactly who you are. Now, there's no question you have to love yourself. There's no question that you can't change who you are because of other people. But the basic message is that you don't need to change. You don't need to grow. Everything you are is exactly the way it's meant to be. But that's the antithesis of the first principle we've been developing, that the entire purpose of life is to grow. But this principle is telling you, you don't need to grow. You're perfect the way you are, which is the exact opposite of everything you're supposed to be doing in life. It's really amazing. And also, a lot of these TV shows and a lot of secular culture is basically this nihilistic culture, which says there is no meaning or depth in life, and there is no purpose, and basically just enjoy life while you can. Because when you die, it's over. There really is no purpose. You are basically wandering meaninglessly through life. Now, that's really depressing, but that's how many people live. So why is TV so enticing? Because if life is meaningless, you might as well escape. You might as well just enjoy it while you can, because there is no reason for life. There is no purpose. There's no thing that you're supposed to be accomplishing. Now, another really important focus in the secular culture is materialism. That you have a culture which is based off of clothes and things, and you are what you own. So I remember when I was in high school, it was unbelievable. I remember very, very vividly that on my shirt, I had to have either a moose or an eagle or some other bird or something in order to be cool, because you are basically defined by your clothes and how you look, and everything is based on what you own. Do you have the cool things? Are you in? Do you have all of these things? It's really, we've discussed that in Judaism, you can't really say mine. You can only say yesh li. There is to me, because you are not your things. But in this culture, there is such a heavy focus on your things. And just to take a next step on the superficiality, Almost all relationships in secular culture are based off of physical looks and infatuation and love at first sight. Just think about every Disney movie. Just take any Disney movie you want. The basic gist of it is that there is a boy who sees a girl, wants the girl, and maybe speaks to the girl in the course of the entire film for a couple minutes, and they're in love and they get married. The sad thing and the funny thing is that they never show you anything after that love story ends. Meaning after they actually get married or finally get to be together, you don't see anything. It's just the entire love story is that infatuation, that romance, that first step. It's all basically artificial. It's all surface. There's nothing deeper. There's no shared mission in life, shared purpose. There's no devoting your lives together to something greater. It gives kids a perception of what love is when that's the farthest thing possible from love. Love is a life of commitment, a life of growth together, of melting into a oneness. And yet you have these little girls who are 11 and they want to be a princess with a boy that never talks to them but just falls in love with them, and he's handsome and she's pretty, and they get a whole ridiculous perception of love. And then you go up and you're a teenager, and that's what you think love is, and that's what you want. So you have guys and girls in high school who have the most ridiculous perception of what they're supposed to be accomplishing when it comes to marriage, when it comes to love. Now, just to take one step further, people waste so much time. You can just imagine it yourself. Someone gets home from school, and what do they think to themselves? How do I kill the next 4 hours? How do I get from today to tomorrow? The most quick and enjoyable way possible. Do you just hear that? And people say it all the time. How do I kill the next 4 hours? And people say when they come home from work too. How do I kill the next couple hours? You're killing your life. You're killing time. Now, I know I'm going a little bit of a rampage here, a little bit of a rant, but I think this is really important to just acknowledge the type of lifestyle that we are in, the type of culture that we live in. So just two last things which I think are really important. Number one is people feel the need to always have more, to always have the newest thing. They're never happy. You get a phone, and the next day a new phone comes out, you have to have that. You have the new laptop, the new clothing, the new car, new house. Everything is always new. People have this consumer mindset that they always want to receive and get more, as opposed to a mindset of what can I contribute? What can I give to the world? What can I give to clientele? How can I give myself to others? Everyone is so focused. I wouldn't say everyone. I'd say a lot of people are so focused on what can I get? What can I receive? How do I get the newest gadget, the newest thing? And the last and one of the most dangerous aspects of our culture is that sports becomes people's religion. It becomes their purpose. They get their meaning and happiness out of life from sports. If anyone is a diehard sports fan, you know this, and if you're not, then you know someone who is, that their entire state is based on whether or not their team won or lost that day. So if you see someone is like smiling from ear to ear, it's because his team won. If someone is depressed and just upset, it's because his team lost. How is that possible that you give away your life to a team? Now, the psychology behind it, and we can give a whole share in this because it's such a deep topic, but this basically becomes their religion. They feel part of the team. People say all the time, we just got that player, or we really need to work on this. You're not part of the team. You're not on the team at all. But when you're a fan, you feel like you are part of the team. You feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself. And when you're at the stadium, you feel like you've melted into a giant crowd and you're high-fiving people even though you don't know them, but we're part of the same team. And you wear the jersey because you identify yourself as part of the team. And you love someone who goes for that same team, whether you know him or not, simply because he goes for that team. Now, what I've just described to you is a religion. For example, take Judaism. We wear our tzitzis. We wear a yarmulke. That's our jersey. That's our beged. We love other Jews just because they're Jews, whether we know them or not. That's achdus. We feel that we're part of something bigger than ourselves. We feel like we melt into this giant collective whole. And our meaning and purpose in life depends on our success. That when terrible things happen to us, we feel down. When amazing things happen to us, we feel collectively amazing. That's a religion. That's a purpose. And why people are so drawn to sports is so obvious, because you don't have to do anything. There's no obligation. It's free. You just show up. Judaism is a responsibility. It's a commitment. In sports, you get everything. You give nothing. So Basically, people have replaced religion with sports, and they get their meaning and purpose from sports. So what I've just described to you in a couple minutes, and I apologize if it's condescending or if you think this is so negative, I'm doing it on purpose because I just want to show you how someone can look at this system, if you're a Haredi, and say, this is ridiculous. This doesn't make any sense. Now, there are always going to be a few individuals who break out of the system and create their own system for themselves. They succeed in life by creating an idealistic lifestyle for themselves. But the problem is that the system itself is geared to making everyone fail. So I'd like to share with you now one of the most depressing things I think I've ever heard in my entire life. I've heard this from many, many, many rebbeim, and most of the high schools have said this behind closed doors. But high schools are basically claiming that their job is to do damage control. Their job is to take kids and just to basically make sure they don't go off the derech, they don't do drugs, they don't do anything crazy until they can finally just ship them off to Israel. And then once they get to Israel, the yeshivas will somehow take care of it. And yeshivas are absolutely upset because they're receiving kids who have basically no skills, no reading skills, they don't care about anything, they're not passionate about Torah, they're not passionate about growth. And the entire Shana Aleph is basically trying to teach these kids basic skills. And if they end up coming back Shana Bet, it's basically Shana Aleph, because the entire Shana Aleph was basically just prep. So here's the basic question. What is the cycle of a kid that goes through the modern Orthodox system? What's the basic cycle of the kid's life? So I've spent a tremendous amount of time thinking about this and trying to develop it. And obviously there's going to be exceptions, but the basic system is as follows. As a child, let's say from the ages of 5 to 13, the kid is exposed to the entire system which I just told you about a couple minutes ago. He's watching TV, he's watching movies, he's following sports, he's completely immersed in secular culture, and he's getting all the values of secular culture, all the values we talked about. Then the kid gets to high school, and his rabbi starts trying to convince him, no, you should learn Torah, you should grow, you should devote your life to Hashem. And the kid's saying, nothing doing. That's not going to happen. Are you kidding me? Like, why would I choose that over everything this culture is giving me? So the rabbi starts playing games. No, I'm cool, I can play basketball with you. Whatever it is, whatever the shtick is, the rabbi starts trying to convince him that somehow Judaism is what he wants. And the kid is simply saying, no. It's not what I want. I want this. I want this culture. I want all the easy, quick fixes, all of the pleasures, all of the excitement that I get from this. Now, you are fighting a losing battle. As a parent, as a rabbi, as a principal, this is not a real battle. So why are the high schools saying we're playing damage control? Because they are playing damage control. I think this is beautifully described. Really, in this year, we haven't been discussing sources, because this is more the hashkafa as opposed to the real depth in the machshava, which we've been developing in great length in the machshava series. But just, I think there's one source which beautifully expresses this. The Gemara in Ksubas, Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, says something amazing. It says, it's discussing the idea of converting a ger katan. So you have a child who comes to the Beis Din, and we want to convert this child. So this is done through the concept of zechiyah. The concept of zechiyah is that since this is good for him, we're able to do it for him without him having da'as. So how zechiyah works, whether it's through slichas, whether it's through something else, that's a whole sugya we're not going to develop right now. But and you can find the concept of zechiyah in the beginning of Gittin. It discusses it by Gittin versus the shtar shichra for an eved, and whether it really is a chus for an eved to be freed. But without getting into all the details, zechiyah is a concept that since it's good for you, we can do it for you, even though you don't really have da'as. Now, the Gemara goes on to ask, but it's not a zechus. Isn't it a chuva to be a Jew? We're saying that since it's such a zechus to become a Jew, you can become a Jew. You can become someone who is part of Klai Yisrael. So since it's such a zechus, we can do it for you. But the Gemara says, it's not a zechus. It's a chuva. You have all these obligations. So the Gemara concludes, and this is amazing. It says, really, it is a zechus, but only if you're already engulfed in all the pleasures and philosophy of a secular life, only then is it a chova. So what's that really saying? This is something so amazing. It's saying that objectively, it's 100% a zechus to be a Jew. That a life of purpose, of meaning, a life, and there is purpose and meaning to the non-Jewish life, but there's no question that there's so much more of an idealistic, higher purpose of being a Jew. And to have this life of purpose and meaning is the biggest zechus you can possibly imagine. However, once a child becomes engulfed in secular culture, and we can apply it now to movies and TV and all these unfiltered devices and everything, that Judaism can't compete subjectively. That even though objectively it is a tchus, once the kid becomes so engulfed and immersed in this culture, to him it's no longer a tchus. And to his mind, he can no longer see the true value of Torah. And we can no longer assert our zechia upon him, since in his mind, he is actively saying, I don't want that. I'd rather watch football. I'd rather have all this social media and TV and all. The Jewish life is not for me. And that's basically what happens. The high school kid is just convinced that he doesn't want any part of this. And what's our success stories? What's the successful high school kid? What's the flip out? The kid who learns a little extra Gemara at night, Seder. The kid who learns a little extra. But most kids who are goody-goodies, who are the good kids, they're not doing anything. They're just not doing anything bad. So our best and brightest are kids who are basically sub-average. In Yerushalayim, you'll find Haredi, you'll find right-wing kids who are 9 years old and they love Torah. But you don't really find that so much. Are there exceptions? Of course. But the system is not creating a love and passion and excitement for Torah, for mitzvos, a love of Hashem, a love of growth, a love of Klal Yisrael. It simply doesn't happen. But what does happen? When these kids go to Eretz Yisrael, they wake up. All of a sudden, they're 17, 18, and they have a higher intellectual capability. That's what we claim. And they go to this atmosphere, this environment, where they're seeing people who are living a life of MS, a life of purpose, a life of Torah. They're happy. They have amazing relationships. They're doing amazing things. And all of a sudden, not everyone, but many, and I would say most kids get inspired. They get uplifted. They say, what was going on the first 17 years of my life? What was I doing? What is going on here? That was a lie. That was sheker. This is the MS. This is what we have to do. This is what I want to do with the rest of my life. And these kids get so inspired, so uplifted. They become motivated. They want to really start learning Torah. They want to develop their midos. They want to develop their relationship with Hashem. They want to start learning Emunah. They want to start... And what happens? 1 year, maybe 2 years... After 2 years of being in Eretz Yisrael, having the most extraordinary experience, deciding they're going to change their lives forever, and deciding that this is the way that we have to live, most kids will come back to America. Some will make aliyah, some will stay in Eretz Yisrael, some will completely flip out, go into the mirror, go... But most will come back to America. And most will go to YU or Landers. Now, some will go to secular colleges, some will go to Columbia, some will go to NYU, whatever it is. But most will go back to YU, will go back to Landers. But this is the really scary part. And it doesn't happen overnight, but slowly but surely, almost all of these people will slowly become more and more desensitized. Now, they're never going to go back to the way they were before they went to Eretz Yisrael. Never! But what will happen is that slowly but surely, they'll become more and more desensitized. All that passion, that idealism, that excitement that they had when they were in Eretz Yisrael, it slowly dissipates. It fades away. And what happens is that they're never going back to the way they were before, but they're starting to do things that they gave up. They're starting to do things they promised they wouldn't do. They get back into movies, back into TV, back into sports. They're starting to hang out with people that they shouldn't be hanging out with, doing things they shouldn't be doing. And what happens is, and even if it isn't that extreme, even if they're still learning and they're still serious, the passion, idealism, the excitement, the things that they committed to when they were in Eretz Yisrael, slowly reality checks in. People say you have to be practical, you have to be realistic, you can't really do that anymore. And they start to become more and more like everyone else in modern orthodoxy. And here's the sad part. They're going to have a TV in their house. Their kid is going to start watching TV and get back into the same culture. And the cycle continues. That deathly cycle simply recreates itself. And the cycle simply doesn't end. It simply happens again and again and again. Now, what are we doing to our kids? Now, I understand if you say, no, I'm selfish, I want to live the life. Okay, that's wrong, but still, oh fine, that's just you. But now you're creating an environment that's going to do the same exact thing to your kids. How can you let that happen? How can we let that happen? We have to have a system that really enables us to succeed, and this system is not helping anyone succeed. Only those who escape the system succeed. But if you want to know the biggest problem... The biggest problem, as Maseil Sharm explains so beautifully, the biggest problem is when people don't even know there's a problem. If you ask most people, they don't even think there's a problem. someone's in real trouble when they're doing something wrong and they don't even know it's wrong, but rather they think it's the right thing. If he doesn't know there's something wrong, he can't fix it. There's no way to improve. I'll give you an example. Let's say someone's trying to help someone, but the person he's trying to help thinks he's doing the right thing. So he's going to reject the help. As a matter of fact, he's going to say, "How dare you? I'm doing the right thing. Why are you trying to help me?" So only once we admit that there's a real problem can we even think and consider finding a solution. So that's the real stuff. That's the Haredi claim, would be that this system is terrible. It doesn't make any sense. Look at the people coming out of the system. How much Torah is there? How much Ahavas Torah is there? How much Ahavas Klal Yisrael is there? What are you really building? And they'll see that, yes, maybe this is a bidyeved. Maybe ideally you should have Torah Mada. You should have a lechatchil life where there's a bunch of uniqueness. But we have to create a very closed culture and a culture of limitation and restriction in order to enable us to maintain Torah. Because I don't see Torah in modern orthodoxy. Yes, there's some Torah. The Rebbeim are really passionate. But what about the masses? What about everyone? And here's the real important claim. Yes, the ideal is Torah Mada. Yes, that might be the ideal. But since you can't do the ideal, as we see from modern orthodoxy, the bidyeved becomes lechatchila. So here's where we come in. This is where we are meant to cut off the cycle. The Haredi claim is beautiful, and I agree with him completely. The system doesn't make any sense. But that's because there never really was a system. There was never a system that was meant to build the ideal way of living life. There was never the ideal Torah Mada system. Because modern orthodoxy was hefker. There was no guidance. There was no gedarim. There was no structure. It was just figure it out and do it yourself. So here's the goal. The goal is to cut off the cycle by taking young kids, the kids that come back from Eretz Yisrael, that are passionate and excited and want to do something, want to fix it, want to live a better life, and instead of allowing them to fall back, to become desensitized, you keep them inspired, you keep them excited, you keep them passionate, and you take them and build a community with them, and then you build a system so that they can raise kids where the kids grow from the start instead of falling back into the cycle. That's the real point where you cut off the cycle. You start new, you start fresh. So that's the goal, and that's what we're going to try to build. But before we can describe how we're going to build this ideal system, we need to establish a couple more principles. These are absolutely fundamental principles, which are going to be the underlying principles, the underlying fundamental ideas that are responsible for everything that we're about to discuss. The first principle is that the ideal is always the balance of extremes. That you're always going to have extremes in life, and the ideal is always finding that perfect balance. So I'll give you a cue, Marshall. Imagine you're going to sleep at night, and you get into your bed, and you go under the covers. But then you start to realize that it's too hot. So instead of putting both your legs under the covers, you put both your legs outside the covers, and your legs are outside the blanket, so you can cool off. But then you realize that you're too cold. You don't want both your legs outside. So what you do is you find that perfect balance where one leg is outside and one leg is inside. That's cute, but that's a basic principle in Machshava, which the Maharal talks about, the Ramchal talks about, which is called Chesed, Din, and Tiferes. Chesed is one extreme, Din is the other extreme, and Tiferes is that perfect balance. So for example, let's say when it comes to rain. Too much rain, the extreme of too much rain, would be a mabul, be a flood. Too little rain, you'd have a famine. But you need to find that perfect balance. When it comes to parenting, if you give your kid too much, you're going to spoil him. If you give him too little, you withhold too much, then it's terrible, it's not nice, it's torturing the kid. The ideal parent is the one that finds the perfect balance. When it comes to teaching, you teach too much material, you teach material that's too difficult for the Talmud, you overwhelm him, you're going to destroy the kid. But if you teach material that's too easy, or you teach too little material, you're not going to give the Talmud what he needs. The ideal Rebbe is the one that finds exactly how to challenge the Talmud without pushing him too far, without giving too much. So the ideal in life is finding the balance of opposites. And not going to an extreme, but finding the way of taking the best of everything. Of finding the balance. Not going to any one extreme level on the spectrum, but finding that middle road, the shvil zahav, that perfect balance. So the next principle is that in life, our goal is to take the best out of everything. And this is based off of the principle throughout the ideas of the Maharal, which is that everything represents potential. So for example, Electricity. You can use electricity properly or improperly. It's just potential. I can use electricity to shock you or to electrocute you, but I can also use electricity to light up a community. Money. You can use money to support Torah, to do amazing things. You can also use it to start a war, to do terrible things. The physical world. You can use the physical world for the most inappropriate things possible. The physical body, you can use food as an end itself. You can, and when it comes to Tashmish Amita, it can be used in the most sensual, animalistic way possible. And yet, we make Kiddush by marriage and Bris Milah. Why? Because we represent the idea of uplifting something which can be used inappropriately for the most appropriate way. That act and that aver, which can be used so animalistically, can also be used in the most kaddish way. Which is why the Ramban explains that the relationship between man and wife is connected to the relationship between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, between you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That it can be the most amazing and uplifting act. Which is why we make Kiddush on Shabbos, we uplift the physical. So this is a fundamental principle that everything can be used appropriately or it can be used inappropriately. And that's also one of the fundamental differences between good and evil. Good is when you use that appropriately. Evil is when you use it inappropriately. It's the misuse of things. And you have free will. You get to decide, am I going to use things appropriately? Am I going to devote them to a higher purpose? Or am I going to misuse and corrupt it? And we discussed in greater depth in Shir number 2 in the Machshava series why we need free will, what the fundamental purpose of free will is. But the next step is that the more power something has, the more potential it has to be used appropriately or inappropriately. So for example, if you have, let's say, just a few volts of electricity, you can charge your phone or you can get a little shock. You can use it appropriately and do something positive, charge your application, or you can use something negative and get a shock. If you have 22,000 volts, you can get electrocuted. That's the major negative, or you can light up an entire community. So the more power, the more potential, the more wisdom, the more money you have, the more anything you have, the more you can use it appropriately or inappropriately. But here's the next concept. That everything in life requires filtering. Since everything can be used appropriately or inappropriately, the way that you use things appropriately is that you have to filter them. So for example, when it comes to food, you might not realize this, I'm sure you do, but when you eat food, you don't just digest it and use it, but you're constantly filtering out what your body needs, and you're discarding what your body doesn't need. All the waste is thrown out, and you keep all the nutrients and all the things that you need. When you breathe, you take in a bunch of air, you filter out what you need, and then you breathe out whatever you don't need. And the same thing when it comes to wisdom. You hear so many ideas. Really foolish people become sponges. Whatever they hear becomes their opinion. They don't think about it. They don't filter. They don't break things down and decide what to keep, what not to keep. Everything they hear, if they're at a speech, let's say, you hear a speech, all of a sudden that becomes your opinion. And next time you hear this conversation with this topic, you just decide whatever you heard at that speech, that's your opinion. But someone who's brilliant, he breaks things down, he filters. He says which ideas make sense, which don't. Which ideas contradict each other, which don't. You have to be filtering everything. But the basic idea of life is that you need to be filtering everything. Take the good out of everything and throw away the bad. Extract the good and dispose of the waste, dispose of the bad. So the basic approach is as follows. If something is pure good, of course you keep it. If something is pure bad, you get rid of it. But what about the gray zone? What if something has a lot of good and a lot of bad to it? So then you have to figure out, can I filter out the bad? If you can filter out the bad, you keep it. If you can't filter out the bad, you don't keep it. So if you want to apply it to Torah Mada, to our system, it'd be basically like this. Now, there's so many applications, but Torah Mada, that's good. You keep that. TV and movies, that's bad. You get rid of that. Now, there are things which are in the middle, which have tremendous good, but tremendous bad. So let's say, for example, internet. Internet has so much good, there's so much Torah on the internet, and there is so much bad. Like, unbelievably amounts of bad. Like, the majority of the internet is full of websites which are as bad as possible. So, first of all, there's no question that you need to filter. If you don't have a filter on your computer, or really any device, it's 100% going to destroy you. There's no question. And if it doesn't, then there might be something wrong with you. Because especially if you're a man, it's going to destroy you. And so many kids have grown up in the system where they didn't have filter devices and they grew up with having no chance to overcome this challenge, and they are messed up because of it. And they live, their marriages are going to be in trouble. Everything is really challenged because of that. But there's no question you have to filter. Now the question is, can you successfully filter? Can you get rid of the bad? This is a real challenge. Because if you can successfully filter, if you can find a way of really building, let's say we're building a community, so the community can successfully filter the internet, then I would say, of course you get the internet, and of course you keep it, because there's so much good. If you can't successfully filter, then that's going to be a real problem. So I would say the ideal is to find a way, and this requires tremendous thought, to really idealistically and successfully filter the internet. But this is basically what has happened. You have two extremes. You have the Haredi right-wing extreme, which there are no filters when it comes to Mada and internet and TV movies. It's just everything goes. Everything is just absolutely no. And then you have Modern Orthodoxy, which there's no filters. But no filters as in everything is just hefker. You can do, basically, yes, there are ideals in life, but figure it out. There's no system that is enabling and creating an actual way to succeed. But what I'm trying to say is that what we have to be doing is create that balance. That's the ideal, where you filter out all the good, you keep all the good, and you get rid of all the bad. And in cases where it's challenging, you find out, you make a real cheshbon, can we successfully keep the good by getting rid of the bad? That's the gray zone. That's where I think internet is the most potent example of that. But I think we can figure out a way of successfully filtering out the internet. Now, the next step, and this is something which I find personally to be so important, is that even within Torah itself, you need to take the best of everything. So people often come over to me and ask me, so which hashkafa would you put yourself in? Would you be this or that? Would you say you're chassidish? Would you say that you're yeshivish, my orthodox? Are you this? Are you that? Now, there's a big problem with boxes. Big problem. Because we have all these different boxes. So, for example, there's a Baal Halacha. Then there's the Baal Iyun, the one who's a Baal Iyun in Gemara. Then there's the Chassid. Then there's the Baal Machshava. Then there's the Baal Musar, Yeshivish, and this. There's so many different boxes. But here's the problem. The problem is that every single box has an advantage. There are pros of every one of these extremes. So the Baal Halacha, he really, really cares about Halacha. He wants to learn all of Halacha, and you need that. The Baal Iyun is developing a real sense of Gemara Be'in, delving into the deepest concepts of Gemara and Shas. The Chassidim are unbelievable. They have so much Avas Hashem, so much Avas Klal Yisrael. If you've ever been around Chassidim, it's amazing. It really is a Chabad. I personally have been very close with a lot of different Chabad organizations. They're unbelievable. So much Ava. The Baal Machshava, they have such depth, delving into the deepest ideas of life. The Baal Musar is spending so much time developing his Midos. These are all different Hashkafas, different boxes. But what's the problem? The problem is that each box places one of these ideals on a pedestal and gives little focus to the others. But the ideal is to have all of these. Even if you don't spend most of your time on each, you still need to have all of them. You need all of them. You need to really care about Halacha. You need to really care about Gemara. You need to have Avas Hashem. You need to love Hashem. You need to love Klal Yisrael. You need to be a Baal Machshava. You have to think. You have to know the deeper aspects of life. You have to be a Baal Musar. You have to work on your Midos. You need everything. The real box, the ideal, is to be a Ben Aliyah. I put myself in the ideal aspect of every category. I value all of them. I want to be everything. I want the best of everything. I don't want to say that I'm going to just do this and forget about everything else. You need everything in life. So everyone tries to put everyone in boxes, but I'm a Jew, and I love every other Jew, and I love everyone. And I don't, you know, identify with this box, and I don't care about everyone else, or I think everyone else is wrong. I think that every single one of these boxes has an idealistic element of life, and I think we need all of them. And this brings us to our next step, which is really our last step, what we've been building this entire time. And if you've been with me until now, let's keep on going, because now we're going to start to establish what we're actually trying to build. What would an ideal community actually look like? So let's start with the ideology and the mission of the community. So it starts with the individual. The goal of your life as an individual is to live a life of growth and becoming the best person you can be. As we described in the beginning, developing yourself in all aspects of life. And here's the most important part, to become the best you that you can be. Now here's one of the most important concepts in life. There should never be any competition. No comparison when it comes to your self-worth. What other people are doing is irrelevant because you were given unique talents. You were given your unique purpose in life. You were born to a specific family at a specific time period with specific capabilities and genetics, and all these specific characteristics were given to you. So what other people are doing should be irrelevant to your own self-worth. The example I love to give, because it's such a big problem, is let's say a kid is naturally brilliant, so he can easily get 100 and ace the test. But he doesn't study at all. He studies for like 5 minutes. And because he didn't study, he got a 99. So his real potential is to get 100. It was supposed to be easy. But he didn't study at all, so he got a 99. Another kid, his potential was to get a 70. He usually gets like low 60s. But he spent 7 hours and studied the entire weekend and devoted all of his time and all of his energy to really mastering the material as best as he could. And he got a 70. So in terms of who did better on the test, the kid who got 70 did much better because he really maximized his potential. But in the regular system, we'd look at the guy who got 99 and we'd say, wow, you're brilliant, amazing, you're going to do amazing things with your life. And we look at the kid who got 70 and say, oh, Nabuch, what can you do? You know, whatever you tried, maybe you'll do better next time. And the kid who got 70 now feels terrible about himself. He's convinced he's a failure. He's convinced he can't do anything. It's awful. You are not like anyone else. Your potential, what you are capable of doing, no one else has that same tafkid. No one else has the same characteristics and abilities as you. And your job in life is simply to become the best you, not better than anyone else, simply better than you were yesterday. Instead of comparing yourself to other people, compare yourself to yourself. So that's the first reason why there should be no comparisons, no competition. The second reason why there should be no competition is because we're all part of the same team. We're all part of Klal Yisrael. So your success is my success. Imagine the nose being jealous of the ear. We're both part of the same body. We both want to succeed and live and thrive and survive. So competition would be irrelevant. It would be crazy. So that's the first step, a life of growth, becoming the best person you can be without any competition. The next step is building a love of Hashem, a love of Torah, a love of mitzvahs, a love of Eretz Yisrael. And lastly, the third step is to love life and to live life with passion, to live life with excitement, with wonder. That's what a Torah life should be giving you. It should be giving you this energy, this vibrancy, this fullness, this wholeness, and to live this life of abundance, a life of excitement. So those are the three steps of living a great life as an individual, developing yourself as much as possible as an individual. The next step, and this is the most important, is then to expand and contribute your life to Klal Yisrael, to live a Klali life, a Klal-oriented life. Now the problem, and this is a major problem in the world, is that people are focused on their own individual lives. They care about their job and their finances, their physical body, their individual pleasure, their individual happiness, their family. What we've done is we've isolated ourselves that our entire existence is our life and our identity. But the ideal, and this is where you get so much of your real meaning and purpose in life, is when you live a Klal-oriented life, where obviously you have to be developing yourself and focusing on yourself, but in the bigger picture, you're identifying yourself as part of a Klal, as part of Klal Yisrael, as part of something bigger than yourself. And you fit into that bigger picture. And then you devote yourself to Klal Yisrael. Your knowledge, so if you're, let's say, a brilliant Talmid Chacham, you give shiurim, or your time, your money, your energy, you simply devote your assets, who you are, what you're capable of contributing, you devote that to the community. You devote that to Klal Yisrael. So imagine now we have a community where everyone is focused on contributing themselves to the community to build something amazing. Now, the problem is that I have looked so hard, I have found that most communities, I'm not saying there are no exceptions, but most communities, I will ask hundreds of people, And they will say that, listen, like, our community is nice, but there's no real ideals. There's no goal for our community. We're just a bunch of people, and we live, and we come together, we daven in shul and Shabbos, and we do our own thing. It's a bunch of people located in a location. But I'm talking about a real idealistic community, where the community as a whole is devoted toward these same goals, to growth, to Torah Mada, to allowing and enabling every person to become the best person they can be, and to collectively invest all of our collective selves into this community, where the community itself is building something. So you're building something as an individual, but then we're building something as a community. That's the ideal. And the next step is that, like we've been discussing earlier, the Torah Mada system, where Torah is the foundation and Mada is the expression. Where in schools, we don't teach Torah and secular studies. Well, first of all, we're definitely not teaching Torah as a subject. That's the biggest problem, that in most schools, Torah is just a subject. Torah is not a subject. Torah is not a subject which you get tested on and you hope you memorize. Torah is something which we want to immerse our kids in them. We want them to love Torah, to love Hashem. But the next step is that we teach Mada through the expression of Torah. Now, that does not mean dumbing down Mada or getting rid of Mada or trying to, you know, filter everything into this kind of fake Mada. It means, and we really have to give a shiur, which hopefully we'll give in the future, on just showing the connections between Torah and Mada. I'm just teaching Mada in an enlightened atmosphere. When you're teaching science and biology and physics and mathematics and psychology, you don't compartmentalize. You don't say, okay, you learned Torah before, now we're going to continue into secular studies. It's all connected. You show the connections. You show the depth. You'd have teachers who are passionate about this type of philosophy, this type of ideology, where they themselves knew the Torah connections. You have a biologist who knows the depth of biology in a Torah perspective and can shed light onto the different reasons of why the body is the way it is. It's a holistic system. And the next step is that we have an actual system of filtration. As opposed to the community just kind of existing and people doing what they want, there will be gedarim. Now, I would say the problem of, let's say, the Haredi system is that there were extreme gedarim. Like, there is nothing. But what we established just a couple minutes ago is the idea of filtration. You get rid of the bad. You get rid of TV and movies. You get rid of the sports culture where your religion is sports. And you invest and create the foundation of life as Torah, as Mada, as growth, as love, as building something amazing as a community. And if we can, like we discussed just a couple moments ago, we build a system where the community has filtered internet. And obviously we're going to filter other things as well, but that would be the biggest challenge, is the filtration of the internet. But the most important part, this is the absolute most important point, it all starts with the parents and the home. That if you have amazing parents, an amazing home, then children will have so much greater a chance of succeeding. Now, that's why I so strongly focused on taking people who are still passionate and idealistic when coming out of Eretz Yisrael, because this only succeeds if you have the people in the community themselves wanting to make this succeed. This is not oppressing rules on people. This is people that want to live this way, that we're going to create an environment which enables you as an individual to succeed, your family to succeed, your children to succeed, building an atmosphere in Avira of growth, of Torah-centered consciousness, a life of purpose. And it really does start in the home. Just think about it. Talking about spirituality in the home, does the word Hashem ever enter the conversation at home? Do parents ever talk to their kids about Hashem? At the Shabbos table, what are you talking about? Are you talking about politics? Are you talking about what's going on? Are you talking about random things in secular culture? Or are you talking about Torah ideas? Are you singing Zmiros? Are you making an uplifting and inspiring Shabbos table for your kids? And here's something which I think is absolutely important. How do parents respond to their kids when the kids are asking deep and really meaningful questions? So when kids ask questions, let's say a 5-year-old kid asking questions about Hashem, asking questions about the world, how many parents will basically just laugh and say, oh, that's so cute? But how often is the real reason that they decide not to answer the questions is because they really just don't know? But instead of admitting they don't know or trying to find the answers, they try to get their kids to stop asking questions. And what this does is it encourages kids to hold in their questions, to stop wondering, to stop being curious, to stop asking about Hashem, and the kids simply are taught that life is the way it is and stop thinking. But if you build a culture of knowledge, of wisdom, of wonder, of curiosity, we want our kids to ask, we want our kids to think, we want our kids to wonder, to live life with a sense of curiosity, of discovery. So if you don't know the answers to your kids' questions, learn. And if you don't know how to learn it, then ask someone else who does. But never let your ego destroy your child's understanding of life. Now, some people don't do it consciously. They don't say, okay, oh, I don't want my kid to know. But subconsciously, they just don't want to admit to their kids that I don't know the answer. But we want our kids to develop. We want our kids to learn, to love to learn, to love to grow. And kids naturally have this sense of, I just want to know everything. I want to learn everything. I just wonder and I'm curious about the world. And it tends to be that we dumb that down, we knock that down, we tell them to stop that. But we need to keep that. Nevi'im, they looked at the world with the same wonder as children. That's what many Baal Machshavah say. Because they kept that wonder, that awe, that oh my gosh sense, which so many adults have lost. So we want to keep that with our kids. So now let's take the next step. Making this happen. How are we going to actually make this happen? So here's one of my favorite principles in life. He who has a why will figure out a how. So our goal is to start an idealistic community based on these deep principles and ideas. To live a life of MS. Now, what's the fundamental why? Why are we doing this? Because this is our purpose. This is why we were created. This is why Hashem created us. Why are you here? No one wants to live a lie. So let's not live a lie. Let's live a life of MS. And here's what comes next. We have the why, but now we have to figure out the how. Just like we talked about the machshava and the hashkafa, so now we have the hashkafa. We know what type of system we want to build, but the question is, how are we going to really build it? So what do we need? So to start, we definitely need a bunch of idealistic young couples or young adults who want to move to this community. We want, let's say, 100 idealistic young couples. And we need amazing teachers. If we're going to build an idealistic type of school system, which is going to really help our kids flourish, then we need to have teachers who are capable of teaching in this type of system. And so what are some of the practical difficulties? So obviously this is not so difficult, but we need to find a place. We need to find a makom to do this. Now the ideal, obviously, is to move to Eretz Yisrael, to do this in Eretz Yisrael. Now the goal ultimately down the line is 100% I want to do this in Eretz Yisrael. But here's what I think. I think there's a tremendous amount of idealism there to throw. I think America really needs something like this. And that's why down the line, of course, I think we really need to also do this in Eretz Yisrael. But where I want to start doing this is in America. Now, where? The real answer is that it has to be anywhere away from modern orthodoxy. I'll tell you why. Several years ago, I'm not going to say where, but several years ago, a pretty idealistic Torah community started in, let's say, some area. I'm not going to say where, I'm not going to say any names. But this was it wasn't anything near what we're discussing here, but it was a very idealistic Torah community. The problem was that they were located right next to another non-idealistic community. And even though they started out very idealistic, over time, osmosis occurred, and people started moving in that didn't share those values. People from the community right next door was right next to it, so everything kind of became one, and the idealism started to fade. And what I want to do is to start out pure, to start out really with, this is the system. If you really share these values, that's why you're going to move here. It's not like you happen to just be in a community next door and now you find yourself here. That we are going to choose to live this type of life, to move to this type of place. Now, the next practical difficulty is money. Now, obviously, anything like this is going to require tremendous finances. And hopefully, we're going to get lots of people that are going to become passionate about this, that are going to want to really help, really contribute. And we'll all go out and try to convince people to really contribute. This is the most amazing cause. And I'm sure that we can inspire people and convince people to really contribute to this amazing cause. So even though, obviously, that's a very significant concern, it's not a concern. It's something which we're going to do. The last step, which I think might be the most fundamental step, is the need for people to overcome the fear of living this type of life. Many people, if they hear this type of shir, will say, oh my gosh, I love this, but I can't do that. That's not for me. Have you ever had the experience where you're just inspired? You see a tremendous Talmid Chacham, or let's say a tremendous Baal Midos, or someone who really takes care of their health, or someone who has amazing relationships, and you just, for a moment, you have this vision of what it would be like if that was you. And you can almost taste it, you can feel it, it's so vivid in your imagination, and you have this vision of this better version of yourself, living this amazing lifestyle, like becoming the best version of you, and you're smiling to yourself and you're saying, ah, yes, that's amazing. And just a second later, this little voice comes up and says, who are you kidding? You can't do that. Come on. You're just normal. There are people who are great, and there are people like you and me. We can't do things like that. And what happens is you let this small voice destroy that inspiration. Because so many of us, we have this small identity. We convince ourselves what we're not capable of doing. And we convince ourselves that there's just a type of lifestyle that we're capable of living, and we're just always destined to be mediocre. And we gave a whole shiur, and this is the first shiur in the Machshava series, of recreating our perception of ourselves, recreating our sense of identity, of what we are and are not capable of doing. And we'll discuss that further in just a couple minutes, but here's something very important. Nothing is perfect. We've been talking about such an ideal society, an ideal community. The community is not going to be perfect, because no society is ever perfect. There is no exception. There will be problems, there will be challenges, but the goal of this community is not to be perfect, because we're never going to be perfect. Until Mashiach comes, even then, you're never going to be perfect. But the goal is to give everyone the best chance of becoming the best person they can be, and that's what we're going to try to do. We're going to be perfect at becoming the type of community that enables us to become the most perfect that we can be. There will always be challenges, there will be difficulties, there will be problems, and that's part of life. But at least give us a chance. We need to at least have a chance of succeeding. And that's what we're trying to create. So here's the last step. The very last step is as follows. People will claim it can't be done. Why? Because it's never been done. So how do you expect to do this? And I will now tell you one of my favorite quotes of all time. History is being read, but it's also being written. That, of course, there are things that haven't been done, but that's life. Life is a process. It's building. Go back in history. Imagine someone went over to Thomas Edison, and I'm sure they did, and they told him, the light bulb? You think you can create a light bulb? Who are you kidding? It's never been done. And imagine he said, you're right, yeah, it's never been done. I guess I should give up. Of course he didn't. He said, it's never been done, but now we're going to create it. Imagine someone went over to the Wright brothers and said, human beings have never been able to fly. So what do you think you're trying to do? We can never do this. What do you think the Wright brothers said? Oh, you're right. We've never been able to fly, so I guess we'll give up. No, they said, we've never been able to do this yet, but we're going to now create it. So what I'm saying is that, of course, it's never been done. Individuals have done it. The most ideal people have done it. But we need to create a system that helps everyone become the best. It shouldn't be that a few individuals become great because they figured it out and everyone else became subject to this ridiculous system. We need to create a system that helps everyone become the best person they can be. So you can't judge your dreams based on memories of the past. You need to expand your vision of yourself and your dreams and your capabilities beyond what you've already experienced of yourself. Because if you think the way you've always thought, and you do what you've always done, you will be the way you've always been. You need to realize that your past does not determine your future. That's the basic understanding of free will. That you have the ability to adapt, to change, to develop. And what I'm saying is that we have to be able to do this. We have to be able to say, yes, it has not been done, but we are going to be the first to do it. And hopefully once we do it, we'll inspire so many others to do it as well. This, I think, is really the idea of the four-minute mile. I'm sure many of you have heard of this idea, but it's one of the most amazing ideas I think anyone can ever hear, because it's this idea exactly. That until 1954, no one could run a mile under 4 minutes. It was scientifically proven to be impossible. And then one day, in 1954, Roger Bannister broke the four-minute mile. And this is something which will blow your mind. A month later, someone else did it. And at the end of the year, 42 people did it. And now, over 60 years later, thousands of people have done it. High school kids can do it now. Nothing changed. It's not because of the shoes or the diet or technique. Once we realized it was possible, once that mental barrier, once that mental prison was broken, all of a sudden, the impossible became possible. And what we need to do is to break that mental barrier. Of course, it hasn't been done, but it needs to be done. You can't let this happen to your kids. We can't let this happen to ourselves. We need to create the hashkafa, the system, which will enable us to live the lives we're meant to live. So I appeal to your minds, but I also appeal to your hearts. This is not just a theoretical shiur. This is not trying to show some brilliant idea. This is meant to actually inspire us to act. And if you're listening to this recording, we want you to make this your dream. This is not my vision, this is not his dream, this is our dream. This is what we need to be doing. This is really what we're supposed to be doing in life. We're supposed to be growing, we're supposed to be doing amazing things, we're supposed to be contributing to something beyond ourselves. We're supposed to be seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in everything, we're supposed to be learning Torah, we're supposed to be doing chesed, we're supposed to be living a great life. And the goal of this year is meant to be the spark of conversation. So that you send this to other people, and you have people talking about this, thinking about this. And if you want to contact me and discuss this with me, ask me any questions, or you have any ideas, or you'd like me to present this idea in your community, then I'm going to give you my email address now, so you can contact me. My email address is shmulireichman95@outlook.com. That's shmulireichman95@outlook.com. shmulireichman95@outlook.com. And I really look forward to be able to build this with everyone. And we're going to do amazing things. I really cannot wait to get this started.